Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, after ignoring a court order about racial profiling, being convicted of contempt of court, and then being pardoned by President Trump, America's former, quote-unquote, toughest sheriff, Joe Arpaio, threw his hat in the ring today for an Arizona Senate seat. Next, the Trump administration is likely to reimpose sanctions on Iran this week, even though it would hurt U.S. manufacturers doing business with that country. Then the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission this week unanimously rejected a proposal by Energy Secretary Rick Perry that would have propped up nuclear and coal power plants struggling in competitive electricity markets. Four of the five members of the commission were appointed by President Trump. Finally, with the ceasefire set to expire, Colombia's government and ELN guerrillas are pushing for a permanent peace deal. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, Joe Arpaio is running for the Senate. After ignoring a court order about racial profiling, being convicted of felony contempt of court, and being pardoned by President Trump, former, quote-unquote, America's toughest sheriff, Joe Arpaio threw his hat in the ring today for an Arizona Senate seat. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan José Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Juan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Joe Arpaio, he's something like 84 or 86 years old. What's he doing? Does he really want to be in the United States Senate, or is this just a last-ditch attempt to try to salvage his reputation in Arizona?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. On the one hand, he wants to salvage his reputation. On the other hand, he wants to make sure that his lifelong commitment to persecuting and terrorizing, arresting and deporting undocumented immigrants continues. He thinks that he can be an important political factor, irrespective of the end result he gets in this election. So he's not really, I believe that he's not really interested in winning, although he would welcome an unexpected win to the U.S. Senate. But I think that what he's really interested in doing is making sure that the anti-immigrant campaign remains front and center, not just in Arizona, but in the entire United States. And he thinks that running for the U.S. Senate is the way to do it.
Donald Trump loves him.
Donald Trump loves him. He agrees with his racist, fascist policies that he pursued in Arizona, you know, where he reinstated chain gangs at what he himself acknowledged were concentration camps, where he incarcerated Mexican and other Latino undocumented immigrants. But, you know, I think that nothing says more about the attitude of Donald Trump towards Joe Arpaio than the pardon that he issued on his criminal conviction for contempt of court last year. So in the Latino community, having back-to-back blows, significant political blows, first yesterday, the announced cancellation of TPS for 265,000 El Salvadorans, and now Joe Arpaio announcing, you know, he's initiating this campaign for the U.S. Senate is just unbelievable. I mean, I think that this takes all air out of any expectation, reasonable expectation that the Latino community had that President Donald Trump was in any way serious about finding a credible solution to the plight of the DACA, the DACA problem. And so I think that what we see in 2018 is nothing but just an all-out anti-immigrant campaign of persecution, arrest, and deportations across the board in our community.
Trump and Jeff Sessions are the vanguard. They're the tip of the spear of this counter-revolutionary assault against immigrant families and against Latinos, this racist campaign. But it's not just Trump and it's not just Sessions. I mean, the Democrats have an option. They have an opportunity right now to say, not only for the DACA recipients, 800,000 to a million, mostly young people, people who came when they were kids, young children, many of them, to the United States without legal papers. They could say, look, we're not going to keep funding the government. We're not going to support this effort unless relief is provided once again to the Dreamers, and also for all the other immigrant communities that are under assault. But what do you expect, Juan Jose? I mean, you're not a partisan person, except for you're a partisan champion of immigrant families. What's likely to happen right now?
What are we to expect from the Democratic Party and the Democrats in Congress, in both chambers of Congress, when they make clear-cut and public commitments to the DACA recipients that they will not bend on funding the government unless and until first that's, there's a solution to their plight in the form of a path to legalization and eventual citizenship. They made this promise last year, and then they caved in and they said, well, you know, we got a firm promise from the president that sometime around mid-January, we'll have a deal that we can live with. And DACA recipients will be taken care of. I don't have any illusions at this point, Brian, that we can rely on any commitment, public or private, by the Democrats, that we can trust their word, you know, that they're going to not budge immediately on the most pressing issue, which is funding of the government before January 19th. Of this year. I think that all the evidence points, you know, that everything is up in the air. The conditions that Donald Trump has placed on the table in order to be agreeable to granting a solution to DACA recipients, an in-depth, you know, and final solution, we can't trust that. I think that the only thing that we can trust, you know, is our determination to continue mobilizing and organizing and being out on the street, making sure that our voice is heard and noticed, not just in the states, but in the world, that human rights are being violated here day in and day out, and that the United States has no moral authority to be condemning other governments across the globe as violators of human rights, where here we have hundreds of thousands and millions of people that are under siege on a daily basis.
Juan Jose, I want to ask you if you can tell us a little bit about the demographics of Arizona and how they're changing. And the reason I'm asking you this is I'm looking at some of these past election results. In the year 2000, Joe Arpaio won his election with 67% of the vote, for example, 40 percentage points over the Democrat. 4 years later, he won 57%. In 2008, he won 55%. In 2012, he won 51%. And then in 2016, he lost and winning only 43% of the vote. So he went from 67% to 43% over the course of 16 years. That has to be a reflection of how Arizona as a state is changing. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's exactly right. The fact that there's this reaction against the Latino population in the United States, and specifically to its immigration segment, has to do in this dramatic shift in demographics in the United States, especially in those states like Arizona, where there are large percentages of the overall state population that happen to be Latino. And of course, they know that at some point, even undocumented workers that are not expelled from the country could expect that there will be some kind of resolution in the form of comprehensive immigration reform. They will become, legal residents and eventual citizens of the United States, making the hold on political power in states like Arizona even more tenuous than the description that you gave of the shift in voter preference for someone like Joe Arpaio over the last 16 years. And I think that really helps explain why there's this violent reaction against immigrants. It's the same type of reaction that we saw, you know, throughout the history of the United States when Irish immigrants came and were severely discriminated against, the Germans and other European nationalities, that although whites, because of their Catholicism or whatever, they were incredibly discriminated until they became fully integrated into the United States. And
until they became white.
Until they became white, yeah.
What, I mean, that's the thing is, like, if you look at the way race and ethnicity was described in the 1890s or the 1880s, There were about 15 races. The Irish were a race. The Italians were a race.
Yeah.
But then, as the great reaction against the American-U.S. Reconstruction took hold in the 1890s, then whiteness became a thing. It became a, you know, maybe America's unofficial religion at that point was whiteness.
Yeah.
And then there you have all non-quote white people being targeted. And it seems to me that Donald Trump is playing this card to the max. I mean, he pardoned Arpaio. And just again, for our audience to understand what a Nazi Arpaio is, he said, again, we talked about the tent city in 1993 as an extension of Maricopa County Jail for convicted and sentenced prisoners. Arpaio, as mentioned, described the tent city as a concentration camp.
That's
it was
correct.
Located in a yard next to a more permanent structure. So he put these people outside on purpose. On July 2nd, 2011, when the temperature in Phoenix hit 118 degrees Fahrenheit, Arpaio measured the temperature inside the tent city tents at 145 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has ruled on that.
You know, but he sent this message that he was truly the toughest sheriff in America.
Yes.
He reinstated chain gangs to make sure that his message was clear. You know, he made inmates wear uniforms that were pink or old-fashioned black and white stripes. You know, and he refused to provide inmates, you know, detainees with, you know, basic necessities, coffee, salt, pepper. I mean, this was a guy that truly wanted to, you know, reignite, you know, the old feelings of hatred and rejection for the foreigner.
Richard Spencer, the leader of the white supremacist Nazi forces that rallied in Charlottesville, he's made the argument, John, that immigration really is the first step in a bigger agenda of the white supremacists. In other words, it's something that they can unite a larger number of people, of white people in particular, and draw them in on some kind of, you know, like with an economic argument, immigrants are taking our jobs. But Spencer obviously has a white nationalist, white supremacist agenda. It's a fascist agenda.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that what we have to think about and consider is not just Arpaio, but how people in this country need to resist against that kind of manifestation of fascism in the United States that takes the form. It takes the form of anti-immigrant, but underneath it all is real fascism.
Well, don't forget, too, that Joe Arpaio said in court on the stand that he was honored to be compared by his detractors to the Ku Klux Klan. He later retracted that, but he said that it was an honor to be compared to the Ku Klux Klan.
45 seconds left, Juan Jose.
Well, obviously, our allies and people who really believe not in fascism, but in democratic practices and way of life are going to do anything and everything we can do to make sure that your pile not only doesn't win, you know, but is relegated to the rubbish heap of history. Because the last thing this country needs is to be moving backwards to the old days of white domination, white racism in the extreme. What we need now is to integrate our communities and move forward to a more democratic country.
Indeed, that was the voice of Juan Jose Gutierrez. He is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition, and he joined us from Los Angeles, California. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is likely to reimpose sanctions on Iran this week, even though it would hurt U.S. manufacturers doing business with the country. We're joined from Washington by Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon to both of you.
I have to ask you a very basic question. What in the world does the U.S. get out of reimposing sanctions on Iran when literally the entire rest of the world is still doing business with Iran?
You know, it's a bewildering question, and it also opens the United States up to accusations of practicing double standards and certainly setting the stage for other countries to say, you can't trust the United States, and we'll go back on its word.
You know, we have a situation right now where there are protests going on in Iran, and they're complicated. But one thing that's not complicated is the Trump administration is saying he loves the Iranian people and he wants to support their protests, and he hopes that their protests result in the overthrow of the Iranian government. And at the same time, if an Iranian applied for a visa to come to the United States, they're banned again because of the Trump administration policy. And then the imposition of economic sanctions can do only damage to those same Iranian people that Trump professes to love so much and support in their struggle for freedom, as he calls it. It's a kind of a stunning level of doublespeak and hypocrisy at the same time, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would. And, you know, I think it's not up to the United States to decide who governs another country or to try to engineer what kinds of discontent might exist, particularly through economic warfare against a country. And it seems also that certainly the United States should set an example, I believe, and engage in unilateral nuclear disarmament itself. But when we are in a situation where the United States has turned the other way, turned a blind eye to our ally Israel and its development of thermonuclear weapons, and now that Iran is in compliance with the International Atomic Energy Association, and there's no disagreement on the part of the International Atomic Energy Association as to whether or not Iran has complied with all of their requests and demands, for the United States to say, well, you know, that doesn't matter to us. We just want to play by rules that we've developed independent of the rest of the world, is really endangering people all over the world.
John, Trump calls the Iran nuclear arms deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the worst deal ever.
Right. As though he's read it.
Yeah.
But yes,
it's
go
the
ahead.
Worst deal ever. Here you have the Iranian government, which has said, even issued a religious decree against nuclear weapons, says it doesn't want nuclear weapons. But it's to verify that it doesn't, it's allowed the most intrusive, comprehensive inspections
yes.
of its facilities of any country in the world.
That's right. Yeah, these are the Iraq inspections to the 10th power.
Right. And then you have the Israeli government, the largest recipient, the Israeli government, the largest recipient of U.S. military and foreign aid, which possesses several hundred nuclear weapons. France helped them build it. Israel isn't part of the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
It
doesn't
not.
Allow weapons inspectors into its
never.
Country. It never will do that. And at the same time, Kathy, the United States has thousands of nuclear weapons. Isn't the United States, it seems to me that the United States is, out of compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, because the quid pro quo is that the nuclear powers agree not to develop their nuclear weapons further and, in fact, begin dismantling nuclear weapons in exchange for non-nuclear powers not acquiring nuclear weapons. I mean, that's the basis of the treaty, right?
Well, that's right. And also, whether or not a nuclear weapon is used, I believe that these weapons are causing death and destruction because they're taking away desperately needed resources that could be used to help cope with the greatest terror we all face, the terror of what we're doing to our own environment. We could be using that genius of scientists to be resolving problems related to disease and world hunger. And certainly now, with the Horn of Africa facing 20 million people who could starve from conflict-driven famine, with Yemen facing 8 million people suffering from starvation. I mean, these are grievous and hideous situations. And for the United States to instead be encouraging its own nuclear arms buildup and then cherry-picking whom it is that we would support to also build up nuclear weaponry, I think is a terrible crime, and it ought to be challenged and it ought to be stopped.
Brian, I want to go back to something that you said a moment ago, jokingly, that Donald Trump has said that this is the worst deal ever. But let me tell you how governments go about working through these deals. This isn't just John Kerry flying to Geneva and sitting down with an Iranian diplomat and working this out over a notebook. Every line of this agreement is sent to the CIA and to the Defense Department, and teams of analysts go over literally every sentence that's in these agreements to say, yes, this is good. No, this is not good. Yes, we have coverage on this, or we lack coverage, or we need to move a satellite, or whatever it is. So they're not just winging it. When a deal like this is negotiated, it has the full backing and support and analytic support, in addition, of the entire intelligence and defense community. So for Donald Trump to say this is the worst deal ever, just it further proves to me that he doesn't have any idea what's in this deal. I will tell you one thing, though, that I think many of us, not many of us, I mean, we look at issues of war and peace and sort of big picture issues, but the business community and Wall Street, for example, should take a look at a piece published by CNBC in October and reiterated in the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago that Boeing, just as an example of one company, Boeing stands to lose $16.6 billion in manufacturing revenue. And that is for 80 jets that it has sold the Iranian, the two different Iranian airlines, its spare parts, and its associated support services. $16.6 billion. We're talking about employment for thousands of Americans in both Washington State and South Carolina. Americans who will be thrown out of work thanks to Donald Trump if these sanctions are reimposed. And that's just one company. I'm just using that as one anecdote.
Well, the point is well taken. To the extent that Iran does business and is integrated into the world economy, if the U.S. capitalist corporations are exempted from that, they obviously will make deals with other companies. I think that's an interesting and good point. Kathy Kelly is our guest. Kathy, in mid-January, Trump will have to decide whether to certify Iran's compliance with the deal. And that's a process that occurs every 90 days, according to the terms of the agreement, but it was imposed by the U.S. Congress on Barack Obama. Obama wasn't really the one pushing for that. And it was pushed both by the Democrats and the Republicans. And then it would be hard to not notice that when the sanctions resolution came up before the U.S. Senate last spring to sanction Russia, North Korea, and Iran, 98 members of the U.S. Senate, only two, Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders, voted no. So it's not really just Trump. It's really almost the entire political establishment is united more or less in doing things that put the United States out of compliance, like imposing new sanctions on Iran.
Well, I think that, you know, people campaigning for elections and re-elections can bet that most of their constituents aren't going to be very informed about Iran, that they're going to see them in a caricatured, almost cartoon-like way, part of the old axis of evil. And if it seems as though maybe they could shore up their capacity to be elected by taking a swipe at Iran, I think that this is the way that United States so-called democracy has been working. Democracy is based on education, and the education is sorely lacking with regard to Iran's compliance with the International Atomic Energy Association.
So what will happen? I mean, it seems to me that Trump is on a road here.
I think so. But I don't see any upside to this. What does the United States get out of reimposing sanctions? It isolates us internationally, and it only harms American workers.
Well, Iran will have an opportunity, I think. Of course, the protests are, they may be subsiding, I'm not sure, but the Iranian government feels, I think, relatively secure right now. I don't feel they feel that these protests are going to end up in sort of a regime change environment, even though the U.S., Britain did the same in 1953 when it overthrew the democratically elected government through the CIA of Mossack Day. The Iranian government, I think, won't be out of breach, will not be in breach of the agreement because it knows, as Kathy has said and as you have said, the rest of the world will consider it to be the United States that's trying to destroy the agreement, not Iran. And as a consequence, the U.S. will be isolated and Iran will not be isolated. So in a way, this, in fact, is another self-inflicted wound on the empire, it seems to me anyway. Kathy, how do you think the politics will play out in Europe?
Well, I don't imagine that people in Europe are paying a whole lot of attention right now to what Donald Trump prescribes for their economies or for their foreign policy or for their integration into world events. And I don't think we should pay a whole lot of attention either. I think that we're sadly governed by a very erratic person who's not thoughtful and difficult to educate. But as you say, it isn't just Donald Trump. We also are a country now that has allowed itself to become a rogue nation in so many different ways, and a great threat and a great menace to people elsewhere in the world. So, you know, the idea of demonization is something that I don't think other countries are practicing in the same way that the United States does. And I don't think that their media organizations are as quick to take on this kind of demonizing and cartoonized foreign policy. So my hope is that other countries won't feel bullied by or the United States, or won't feel that they have to be subservient to U.S. policy. However, we do have Saudi Arabia in a rivalry with Iran and using many different means to try to promote some kind of triumph over Iran. And I think that's extremely dangerous. And I hope that other countries will condemn the Saudi government and the Saudi-led coalition for what they're doing.
Speaking of the Saudis, in our last minute, Kathy Kelly, talk, if you would, because you've been following the events in Yemen, just tell people in brief what's happening in Yemen, because, again, a humanitarian crisis of such huge magnitude. And how, if people want to support your work, can they get in touch with you?
Well, for instance, I'm part of the Witness Against Torture Fast today, and we're going to go to the embassy of the United Arab Emirates, because apparently the United Arab Emirates, in coalition with Saudi Arabia, are running clandestine prisons where gruesome torture takes place in various parts throughout Yemen, which makes it so difficult for people in Yemen to speak up. They're terrified of what could happen. And of course, the civil war rages on, but it's exacerbated because with U.S. support and with the United States refueling jets in midair, with the United States constantly sharing surveillance, the Saudis have been able to continue bombing Yemen repeatedly, bombing infrastructure, bombing hospitals, and people there are facing starvation. You know, 8 million people could starve to death, and this is a hideous and a tortuous way for children to die. So people, I think, can become better educated all the time. Our website has the regular articles at vcnv.org. Anybody in the New York area, every Saturday, go to a demonstration in Union Square that begins at 11 a.m. And people in Washington, D.C., please stay in touch with the Witness Against Torture Fast and protest against all forms of torture during this week.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission this week unanimously rejected a proposal by Energy Secretary Rick Perry that would have propped up nuclear and coal power plants struggling in competitive electricity markets. Four of the five members of the commission were appointed by President Trump. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Professor Magdoff, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Without overstating the case, is this the beginning of the end for coal? If they can't even get a subsidy with a panel stacked by Donald Trump to protect and prop up coal prices, is this the end?
I wouldn't say it's the end of coal, but it certainly is. Essentially what's happened is that prices of gas, natural gas, have come down dramatically, and the prices for solar and wind have come down dramatically. and nuclear and coal have a hard time competing. So quite a few coal plants have already shut down, and nuclear plants have shut down because it's cheaper to shut them down than it is to keep running them. So the whole plan was to subsidize them, and to subsidize coal and to subsidize nuclear, in order to, you know, keep them going, basically. And the question is, you know, if that subsidy doesn't go through, which is apparently happening, and that means that that plants will have a hard time in this economic environment. But it doesn't mean they're necessarily all going to go out of business. And as I just mentioned, you know, a number, 20 some odd, I've forgotten what it is, coal generating plants and some nuclear plants have gone defunct. And no new ones are being built at this point. And so I guess what I'm saying is that it doesn't necessarily mean the end of coal and the end of nuclear in any short order. I think over time, it does not bode well for either of those industries. But if you have a plant that's up and running, you have a lot of costs that might be associated with paying off the debt on what, you know, to build the plant, and therefore you keep it running even at a loss. If the loss gets too great, then you have to shut the plant down.
We're looking at a decision taken by this panel that has nothing to do with what's best for the environment, it seems like.
This is
just a calculation, a capitalist economic calculation regarding energy sources and profits and what's viable. Fred Magdoff is our guest. You wrote two books, or maybe many more, but two that we're looking at: What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. Now, here's the problem, is that Donald Trump is appealing and has been appealing to workers in coal country and saying, I'm going to bring back coal because I'm going to help you because you're getting poorer and poorer. Your wages are being dropping. The mines are closing. What is the kind of revolutionary transformation that needs to happen so that society can move to green energy sources, to renewable energy sources, and at the same time protect the lives and livelihoods of coal miners and of other workers who are being displaced for no fault of their own?
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount that can be done within our economic system and, the way it functions now. And things are happening. I mean, there is a lot of wind and a lot of solar going in. As a matter of fact, I think Texas is probably the wind capital of the United States. You've got some days, there was a report last year, I think, some days during the year where there was so much wind power, they were paying you to take it. You know, it was it was a tremendous amount of excess capacity when the wind was blowing, and they didn't have storage for it, which they're developing, you know, battery storage and other storage systems for storing electricity from these intermittent sources like wind and solar.
That was kind of the hook, too, was storage. I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post today saying that Secretary Perry's proposal favored power plants able to store a 90-day fuel supply on site, unlike renewable energy or natural gas plants, which cannot.
Right. I mean, that was there. It was specifically for plants that could do that. And the only plants that can do that are coal and nuclear. So it was written for the coal and nuclear industries. That's what Rick Perry's, you know, plan was written for. Gas can't do that because it comes by pipeline, so it's not stored on site. So this was something that was clearly done to try to enhance the profitability of the coal and the nuclear industries. And it goes against the ideology of free markets. So let the market decide. You know, the market's deciding. The market's deciding that gas and that wind and that solar are cheaper than coal and nuclear. And they don't want to face that. So your question is to what could be, as I mentioned, how do we get from here to there? And there are certain things that are happening now, but it's not enough, and it's not happening quickly enough. And my overall take on the ecological problems that we have in our society, which is not just climate change, but also the pollution of the air, the water, the soil, the species, you know, disappearance, the extinctions that are happening. The various and sundry ecological problems that we're facing are almost impossible, if not impossible, to solve within a capitalist framework, because the system operates on profits, and the whole purpose of the economy is to produce profits. And then when that happens, everything else becomes basically irrelevant. And it's what economists call externalities. There are things that happen that the individual company didn't plan to happen, but they happen as a normal outcome of how they operate. And, you know, a company that's putting CO2 in the atmosphere, that's not their purpose. They're not trying to put CO2 in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide. What they're doing is they're trying to produce electricity.
Right.
So to make money at it. So when that's the case, you have this externality of the carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. So my take is that what you need is a society and an economy that operates differently, that operates on principles that we're producing things not for profit, for private profit, but we're producing whatever we're producing for basically for people.
Fred, I think I've mentioned to you a couple of other times or one other time on this show, if you're driving down the Pennsylvania Turnpike or Interstate 80 through Pennsylvania, you see these enormous billboards saying that wind dies, the sun sets, but we'll always have coal. And you see other billboards lauding the advent of clean coal. Is there any such thing as clean coal? I know that coal can be made into some sort of gypsum-like material that's used in fiberboard. We tend to buy almost all of that from China, but is there some use of coal here in the United States that does not damage the environment?
No. Not in any significant quantity.
So there is no such thing as clean coal.
No, mostly what they're talking about clean coal is cleaning up coal, you know, washing it and trying to clean up some of the impurities before it gets burned. This is not a reality. You end up with other pollutants. You end up still with plenty of pollution from the coal itself. So the idea of clean coal is to be used in power plants. But yes, there is no such thing as clean coal.
That's the voice of Fred Magdoff. We're speaking to Fred from Burlington, Vermont. He is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont. I want to go back to the issues of the economics of this and also international trade, because Donald Trump is threatening to place tariffs on imported solar panels from China. He says that China's unfairly subsidizing its solar panel industry, and that hurts Americans. So he's going to maybe impose tariffs, which will just make solar panels more expensive for people in the United States. And yet at the same time, Trump is demanding subsidies for coal and nuclear plants in the United States, which would be precisely the same thing that he alleges China is doing. I mean, that's what America first, that's what this kind of protectionism means. But of course, China will and they must retaliate. In other words, we're looking possibly at an economic trade war if that were to happen. But in this case, it's not just business that has a stake. It's people who also care about the environment, because solar panels will actually make a difference. Anyway, what do you think?
Well, first off, there's certainly no shortage of hypocrisy within the administration and within the Republican Party as a whole, I would say, so that they can criticize one country for doing something like subsidizing solar, which I'm not even sure the Chinese are doing. And at the same time, they can make a proposal to subsidize coal and nuclear. So the hypocrisy on almost everything they do is just it's so blatant. They were very concerned. The Republicans have been very concerned for years about the deficit. You can't increase the deficit. It's so terrible. And then here they pass, because they want to give tax breaks to the wealthy, they pass a law that's going to increase the deficit by at least $1.5 trillion. And you don't hear a peep out of them. All of a sudden, the deficit is irrelevant. So this is real hypocrisy. The other thing I want to mention about solar is, and solar coming from China, is even solar panels coming from China produce jobs in the United States because there are people that need to install them. And so the installation of these new technologies has actually produced a significant number of jobs in the U.S.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And how does that change? We have about 2 minutes left. How does that change? Where do we go from here? If we, as a country, if we've made this decision, and it looks like the decision's being made for the government to walk away from coal in the direction of renewable energies, and if the big car companies, as another example, are even transitioning away from combustion engines to electric, where do we go on these coal issues?
Well, on the coal issues, it's tough. I mean, on the coal issues, it's tough. The first off, a lot of the loss of jobs in the coal industry was not due to anything Obama did or anything else, but a lot of it was due to the decline in jobs due to automation. Blowing up mountaintops and then accessing the coal is a lot. You need a lot fewer workers than when you actually have coal pits and mines that you have to go into and dig out the coal by hand. So this is finding meaningful jobs for coal miners, meaningful jobs for people who are displaced from various industries is a very important and it's a very progressive thing to do. But the question is, you need a government program to do that.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Fred Magdoff, that is Professor Emeritus Fred Magdoff. He is a professor of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Thanks for joining us. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
With a ceasefire set to expire, Colombia's government and ELN guerrillas are pushing for a permanent peace deal. The outcome of the talks could even decide the next presidential election. We're joined from Tucson by James Jordan. He's a member of the Alliance for Global Justice and has been deeply involved in supporting the peace process. James, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
James, the ceasefire ends, I believe it's today. So what happens next?
I think that's what everybody's waiting to find out. Both the government and the ELN have called for continuation of the peace talks. And they're both talking about continuing the ceasefire. But as of now, the ceasefire isn't in effect. I'm very concerned about something else that's happening right now that was announced, I believe, yesterday. And that is that the government is sending 2,000 plus troops to the area of Tumaco, Nariño. And this is an area where there's been a lot of fighting between among narco traffickers, groups from the FARC, renegade groups from the FARC that aren't supporting the peace accords and the ELN. It's really kind of an epicenter of political violence and narco violence and all kinds of struggles going on there. It's been the site of massacres and human rights abuses by the military and the national police and paramilitary groups. And I think it's really worrisome that at the same time the ceasefire is happening, that the government is sending in a whole lot of troops to this area.
Yeah, that's an important point. I'm looking at a piece in the Colombian press saying that despite the fact that the ceasefire has been in place for a year, there were still just under 11,500 homicides in Colombia, and many of them were carried out by narco traffickers.
Right. Yeah, the narco traffickers, I mean, the myth has been in the past that the FARC. Now, I know more about the FARC in this regard than I do about the ELN, but the myth has been that the FARC and the ELN have been hugely involved in narco trafficking and have profited greatly from this. And this it's a myth. What the FARC and the ELN have mainly profited from regarding narco trafficking, if you can call it profiting, is that they have taxed narco traffickers in the absence of any alternative economy for the campesinos in the areas. And I think that we're also seeing that with their taxing and with their providing some form of stability in the absence of a government presence, that now we're seeing with the FARC pulling out of these areas, that narco traffickers are stepping in and filling in the vacuum yet more. And this is causing a lot of violence to rise.
We're speaking with James Jordan. He's a member of the Alliance for Global Justice from Tucson. James, I think a lot of people don't really know what's going on in Colombia. Seems very distant. If you're relying on the corporate-owned mass media, so to speak, you will know even less. So let's just try to dissect what's going on. The FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, began an armed struggle back in the early 1960s. I believe it was 1964. That was 5 years after the Cuban Revolution. The United States government supported the Colombian military in trying to suppress the FARC. This civil war, this armed struggle has gone on for a half a century. Now, as a consequence of an initiative that took place in Cuba, and I think you were there as part of the process, negotiations happened between the Santos government and the FARC. And now we have a ceasefire with the idea that the FARC would be reintegrated or integrate into Colombia's political process and be a part of the political struggle. In other words, seeking the same goals, that is a goal of social justice and land reform, but through other means in a different arena than on the battlefield. But then there are other forces inside the Colombian establishment and more right-wing forces than Santos who are trying to sabotage this agreement. And the way they can sabotage it is by killing the now disarmed members of the FARC because they don't have arms. In other words, they're vulnerable. Is that what's going on?
I think you summed it up pretty well. That's a big part of what's going on. And not just the disarmed FARC members. That of course, a big problem. And the recently released or in process of being released political prisoners and prisoners of war, these are being targeted. But even more worrisome is the targeting of the social and popular movements themselves, because that has been even more violence towards these people. And one might question if this is occurring because there's no one to defend them anymore. It's a very legitimate question. It has to be a question that the ELN is asking right now during this time of negotiations. I don't think there's any way that the FARC, as it existed in the past, is going to reappear. They haven't just laid down their arms, they've turned them over. But this violence is continuing. The attacks on the peace process are severe, and I'm worried about the future. I'm also worried it's of course the illegal attacks, the violent attacks, legal and illegal. Well, they're all, you know, abuses, but by both the military and the paramilitaries, these are very worrisome, and the assassinations. But it's also worrisome, the political strength of the extreme right. And we have national elections are going to be taking place between March and June. And these elections could be an important victory or a huge blow to peace in Colombia.
John, I think people don't, again, understand, if they're not paying careful attention, that this isn't simply an ideological struggle between right-wing conservatives and radical leftists.
Right.
That what's going on is that the ultra-right paramilitaries are associated with the big landlords. In other words, they have material interests.
That's right.
And the peasants who don't have land or have very little land, they want to divide up the land of the landlords, the big landed estates. So the landed estates use right-wing paramilitaries to terrorize the peasants. The FARC was the guarantor in some ways, the military protective force for the peasants who are poor and hungry and yearning for social justice and land reform. So what James is saying basically is if the FARC for political reasons says, yes, we agree to a ceasefire, yes, we're going to lay down our arms, that in some ways makes their constituency, their base, the poor peasantry, vulnerable to these right-wing paramilitaries who are not disarmed.
Yeah, that's right. Not every major group is even participating in these peace talks or in this ceasefire. There are outlying groups, and they tend to be extremist groups, reactionary right and drug kingpins. This is a very tough situation for the Colombian government and even for the FARC.
James Jordan, go ahead.
Yeah, I think this is all true. The big landowners, the narco traffickers and the big landowners, pretty much oftentimes the same. Also, the extractivist industries and transnational corporations, the paramilitaries are all at the behest of these interests. And I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the fact that the FARC not only provided military protection, but also provided some the services that governments would normally provide in these areas that have been neglected and abandoned by the state. Right now, the peace accords are supposed to be resulting in less abandonment, more in investment in voluntary eradication, development of roads and schools and healthcare and the infrastructure to not only reintegrate the FARC, but to reintegrate the rural areas into the national economy. And that needs to happen for the peace to be at all viable and for the peace to last. So this is very worrisome. One thing, though, that I do know that the people that negotiated this peace, they have been optimistic about international interests, international observation and solidarity and support and monitoring for the peace accords. They believe that there are more institutions both within Colombia and outside of Colombia to provide the awareness to keep this peace process on track. Here's hoping that this isn't just wishful thinking. It is a very worrisome problem. And you hit on something very important a little while ago about people not knowing about it. And I think there's reasons that Colombia is not portrayed often enough in our mainstream media. First of all, if you listen to the mainstream media, you're going to be thinking that Venezuela is a complete shambles when frequently the same indicators that we talk about in Venezuela are far more worse in Colombia. You know, but you don't hear about that. And I think you don't hear about that is because the Pentagon and the U.S. government themselves don't want us to hear about that. Colombia is so important because of its access to U.S. military and the U.S. military support that Colombia has gotten that makes it a key piece to U.S. hegemony throughout the Americas. And the other thing, of course, is just the huge riches that Colombia has and that the 1% wants to plunder. I was talking about this area in Tumaco, where so much military activity is going on right now. Most of that is centered around the eradication, forced eradication of illicit crops. And that is something that the White House is really pushing Colombia to pursue, to abandon the voluntary eradication with infrastructure investment that's a result of the peace accords in favor of the more belligerent attitude. So it's that what's going on, I believe, is at least partially a response to the lobbying of the Trump administration to focus less on peaceful change and focus more on going in with troops. But it's not just about drugs. And that's again, it's the big myth, the big lie of today. Tumaco, that region, is an area with heavy investment in palm oil development, lots of mineral wealth. One of the most important pipelines ends there at Tumaco, which is also one of Colombia's most important ports. So this war is a war against small farmers. It's a war, well, again, war. I'm calling it war. It's not officially a war anymore, I guess, or they're trying to bring it down. But we're seeing a huge escalation going hand in hand with the end of this ceasefire and going hand in hand with increased political violence against social movements, against ex-insurgents, and a very worrisome political season coming up, electoral season coming up.
James Jordan makes a good point, John. If it wasn't really for the United States and U.S. intervention And the United States does not have pristine interests. They have the interests of domination.
Sure.
Of course, Latin America has been, you know, since the Monroe Doctrine, America announced this belongs to us.
Sure.
Doesn't belong to the people of Latin America.
And as far as the CIA and DEA are concerned, it's all about drugs and communism.
Yeah. And for as James is pointing out, for the Pentagon, Colombia, starting for a long time, but certainly with Plan Colombia and going forward, a big part of U.S. geostrategic and military calculations hinge on Colombia having a government that is fundamentally loyal, first and foremost, to the Pentagon.
Without a doubt. Yeah, without a doubt. It results in millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in arms sales.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from Tucson by James Jordan. He's a member of the Alliance for Global Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or at SputnikNews.com or as an iTunes podcast. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. Thank you.